From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, two cover stories. First, could pro-Republican super PAC still claim victory if Mitt Romney loses?
Oh, absolutely. And we're directionally looking at spending about $70 million on Senate-level advocacy.
The super PAC's battle to win the Senate, and then a look at the price of democracy in the Middle East. Also, how $500,000 turned one rabbi's quixotic congressional campaign into a contender, and still, people always tell him,
"You're a rabbi, you're supposed to be dealing with lofty matters, stay in the heavens and leave us politicians to control the earth."
Rabbi Shmuley tries to bring some shalom in the home to Capitol Hill, plus how President Obama may be trying to become the beer president. Also, we're going to check in with
the most interesting man in the world.
He does exist, and he faces a challenge from Russian leader Vladimir Putin.
I've been consulting with him for some time. He's a good student.
Later, theologian Brian McLaren asks, why did Jesus, Muhammad, the Buddha, and Moses cross the road, and how a Korean rapper became America's hottest new star?
Open Gangnam Style!
The artist known as Psy brings some Gangnam Style to NPR, plus Iggy Pop and Joe Jackson, like you've never heard them before.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
New Wave and Punk meets Duke Ellington. That's all in this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. Polls can be unstable. Up until the last moment, Jimmy Carter was leading Ronald Reagan in 1980. And in the past 2 weeks, President Obama has started to pull ahead of Mitt Romney. Romney's campaign is hoping for a reversal of fortune within the next 50 days or so. But judging by the way some of the biggest pro-Republican super PACs are spending their money, it could be a sign that they think they might have a better chance retaking the Senate than winning the White House. Crossroads, for example, the super PAC founded by Karl Rove, is working to turn several Democratic Senate seats into Republican ones. In Florida,
and time to send a message to Bill Nelson, who voted for the wasteful $800 billion stimulus he said would jumpstart the economy.
In Ohio,
coming to you this year, the healthcare takeover. Taxes on Ohio businesses that could kill jobs. Sherrod Brown gives two thumbs up.
And in Virginia,
Tim Kaine left Virginia for Washington and was a cheerleader for massive spending.
Because the stimulus is working.
But it actually wasted money studying ants in Africa.
Our cover story today, are some of the big money GOP super PACs shifting strategy away from the presidential race and into the congressional ones? In a moment, we'll put that question to a senior member of the Crossroads super PAC. But first, to NPR's Ari Shapiro, who's been on the campaign trail with Mitt Romney these past 2 weeks.
I think this campaign has had an extremely difficult week. It's hard to compare what it was like at moments in the primary, for example, when Newt Gingrich dominated in South Carolina, to now when it's the general election against Barack Obama. But the fact is, in addition to the tough poll numbers, they had this sort of unexpected crisis in Libya where even some prominent Republicans criticized Romney's handling of it. In addition, there was some criticism about the amount of campaigning that he's been doing. It seems like less than other candidates at this point in the race. So you had a few different fronts in which the Romney campaign was on the defensive, and the question is, will they bounce back?
We are going to hear in just a moment from Jonathan Collegio, who works for American Crossroads, the Karl Rove founded super PAC. We've talked to some Republicans who've told us, sort of on background, that, you know, even if Romney loses, they could eke out a victory with the Senate. But it was interesting because you are starting to hear that unnamed Republicans saying, well, you know, the White House may not work out, but we may claim victory in other places.
There's been a really interesting push-pull through this entire campaign between the Republican establishment and Mitt Romney, where Mitt Romney has always sort of been the guy who had the endorsements, who had the money, who was next in line, but who the Republican Party was always a little bit uncomfortable with, whether it was the Tea Party base or whether it was evangelicals who were suspicious of a Mormon candidate, or whether it was just somebody who said he doesn't have the charisma of a Mike Huckabee. So this theme we're hearing now from Republicans of even if Mitt Romney doesn't win the White House is not a new theme.
Yeah. Ari, I know it's an art, not a science, but are you getting any sense from members of the Romney team that they are getting a bit defensive? Or does it seem like everything is under control and everybody's operating as usual?
Well, there was a senior aide who told me that their internal polls are far more favorable than the public polls that the American people are looking at. You don't say that if you're not feeling a little bit defensive. They know they need to stage some kind of a comeback. They're putting a lot of faith in that being the debates. that Romney has spent a lot of time preparing for. And that may be the last best chance for Mitt Romney to really change the dynamic of this race. And that's what his campaign is putting a lot of stake into.
That's NPR's White House correspondent Ari Shapiro, who also covers the Mitt Romney campaign. Ari, thanks.
You're welcome.
This past week, something mysterious happened. Two of the biggest super PACs supporting Mitt Romney went dark. They didn't run any ads, and many reporters covering the story haven't been able to figure out why, including Noam Scheiber with The New Republic.
Now, there's any number of reasons why a super PAC could go off the air. They're just reevaluating, recalibrating, trying to figure out what worked, what didn't. But it was a moment that would give you reason to recalibrate, given Obama's post-convention bounce. He's looking like he's got persistent leads in Ohio, which is obviously a key electoral college state. But not just Ohio. It looks like Florida is looking, you know, I think early on people thought Obama would just faint to Florida and the Romney campaign would eventually lock it down. That's not really happened. And we've actually seen the reverse. Obama is building this persistent lead, and the Obama campaign is really starting to invest a lot of money in Florida. So I think the super PACs, if nothing else, want to see how that whole picture shakes out before they decide where they're going to allocate their resources going forward.
Have you gotten a sense from some of these super PACs, particularly the pro-GOP super PACs, that they have come to a conclusion that maybe Romney won't win, but that they can still eke out a victory by pouring money into Senate campaigns to make sure that the GOP captures the Senate?
Well, I think you have to do this indirectly. There are some places where it's impossible to tell, because even if they were giving up on Romney in Ohio, they would still try to target the Senate race. Same thing in Virginia. The places I think you would look are places like Indiana, Montana, North Dakota even, races that at the beginning of the cycle, the GOP thought these were going to be pretty reliable wins. If this were developing, you would start to see a lot more money being thrown at states like that. You know, I mean, look, Ohio and Florida, they're going to keep spending money in those states, even if Romney's looking incredibly grim, not just because they're competitive Senate races, because they've raised so many hundreds of millions of dollars. Where else are you going to spend it, right?
About 50 days before the election now, what kind of strategy shift do you think we can expect to see from some of these super PACs in the coming days and weeks?
Well, I do really think it is these other Senate races. They may even take a crack in a place like, you know, Maine. You have New Mexico, which is, you know, as of 2004, was a pretty close place partisan-wise, but has since then kind of tilted toward the Democrats. But I could see Republicans investing a little more money in a New Mexico Senate race, the calculus being, well, Senate races, you know, are places where $500,000 could really turn the whole proposition. And, you know, as long as you're sitting on $500 million and this presidential race is not looking like it's trending your way, it's worth a shot.
That's Noam Scheiber. He covers politics for The New Republic. Now, if Mitt Romney doesn't win the White House, Republicans believe they could still eke out a victory by retaking the Senate, which is now controlled by Democrats.
Democrats have twice as many seats that they're defending in the elections of 2012 as Republicans in the Senate. And Republicans need to pick up a net of four seats in order to win.
That's Jonathan Collegio, Communications Director for American Crossroads, the pro-GOP super PAC founded by Karl Rove. He says in the next few weeks, there could come a time when some conservative super PACs decide the presidency isn't worth the fight.
In theory, yes, but we're nowhere near that at this point. We have a goal of a fundraising goal for the 2011-2012 cycle of approximately $240 to $300 million. We always thought that we would spend a majority of that on presidential level advocacy, both issue advocacy and political advocacy. And I don't think a serious observer could look at that map right now and say that this is not highly competitive. National polls have it within 1 or 2 points. And these state-by-state polls, everywhere where Romney has to win, is within the margin of error.
But in theory, if not in fact, I mean, if your resources were to focus on winning the Senate and Obama was reelected, President Obama was reelected, presumably the congressional Republicans could thwart an Obama agenda for at least 2 years and most likely 4 years. Could that also be a scenario that would be advantageous from your point of view?
Oh, absolutely. And we've actually dedicated, we're directionally looking at spending about $70 million on Senate-level advocacy. So a significant amount of the Crossroads Group's expenditures are going to be dedicated toward the House and the Senate.
Let me ask you a question about tracking the money, because, of course, your opponents, I mean, pro-Democratic groups are also spending money. How do you track how they're spending money to figure out where you need to be spending money?
A couple different ways. The first way you would look is if an ad is classified as a campaign ad by the Federal Elections Commission, you would see reports of where those expenditures are taking place. The other way you would do it is that there are services where you can look at the types of advertisements that are going on television. I could see how much Procter & Gamble is spending to promote one of its products, and I can also see how much the Democratic National Committee is spending to promote one of its candidates.
How much does that influence how you guys spend?
Oh, absolutely. We get those reports every day. You kind of look at it as a giant, sophisticated chess game.
And they're presumably doing the same thing.
They are doing the same thing, yeah. We will get, in fact, sometimes I will hear from reporters about where money is going before I hear from the tracking services. Because if they want to make news about how they're going to be strategically placing money someplace, sometimes it'll get leaked to a reporter before it gets leaked publicly. But a lot of it is a strategy that we keep close to our vest. We do work with a lot of other like-minded groups to make sure, for example, that there's no duplicity of spending. You know, if Crossroads is going to be on the air in Florida with an ad, we want to make sure that in that same week, another group doesn't have an identical message on the air, because that would be you'd lose some of the effectiveness of the money going on. So we do share those plans with other like-minded groups.
We've had Bill Burton on the show, who runs a Priorities USA, and he kind of created this inspired by Karl Rove. It's a pro-Obama super PAC, has about a third the amount of money you guys have. I mean, does American Crossroads sort of look out at particularly PACs like Priorities USA and other groups and say, man, we're just killing it. I mean, we don't really have any serious competitors.
Oh, I think that there are competitors, but maybe they're not the competitors that people would think at first blush. Labor unions are basically the kind of juggernaut on the left that we sought to balance out with our spending on the right in 2010. You also have to look at groups like MoveOn.org and America Coming Together.
Are they spending a whole lot this year?
No, they're not. But just as Bill Burton could say that he got the idea from American Crossroads on forming the Obama Super PAC, we got a lot of those ideas from how the Democrats tried to defeat President Bush in 2004. Remember, they spent $200 million of outside money trying to defeat President Bush in 2004.
So you guys are all getting ideas from each other.
Yeah.
You should have a big party. At the end of all this, because it is, part of it is a game. I mean, this we are talking about a strategy to win, but there is a lot of strategy involved.
It's a lot. It's a giant chessboard, and every move that you make has implications not only with where you're moving, but how it impacts the spot that you left.
That's Jonathan Collegio with the pro-GOP super PAC, American Crossroads. By the way, conservative outside groups, including super PACs, have outraised pro-democratic ones by nearly four times. Coming up, more politics, how celebrity rabbi Shmuley Boteach wants to bring some shalom in the home to Capitol Hill. Stay with us. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. Nearly 2 years ago, mass demonstrations against autocrats in Arab countries captivated the world. The Arab Spring would bring democracy, and in many countries, a form of it has come. So, too, has the freedom of assembly and protest, something previous rulers could quash. No longer. And much of that anger is directed towards the United States. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on Friday.
The people of Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Tunisia did not trade the tyranny of a dictator for the tyranny of a mob.
Our cover story today, the price of democracy in the Arab world. From Tahrir Square to Yemen to Gaza, Muslim demonstrators have taken to the streets this week, sometimes violently, to protest a crude and obscure film that demeans the Prophet Muhammad. The question many Middle East watchers are now asking is whether these protests are really about this film or about something much more complicated. For more, I'm joined by Rami Khoury with the American University of Beirut and a senior fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center. Rami, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also joining the conversation is Stephen Cook, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to you.
Hi, Guy.
Back in 2006, when fighting broke out between Israel and Lebanon, then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice characterized it as the birth pangs of democracy. First to you, Stephen Cook, the anti-American violence in Libya, Tunisia, Egypt, and elsewhere, the birth pangs of democracy?
Well, I don't know whether they are the birth pangs of democracy. It certainly could be. We do know that countries that are in transition tend to be unstable. The politics there are uncertain, and periodic spasms of violence could break out at any time. We also know that the uprisings throughout the region were about national dignity and self-empowerment. And I think the United States, by and large, represents an overarching power in the region that has been in the region in robust ways, to use a euphemism, over the course of the last decade. But what we are seeing is not just a reaction to this film clip, this trailer, this movie, whatever it is you want to call it, but an expression of frustration and a desire to throw off what people see as a power that has not been in the region to be benevolent, even though Americans look at it, adjust to this new reality.
Rami Khoury, in reality now, any person in the world, anyone with access to the internet, can easily set off a conflagration in parts of the Islamic world by simply insulting the Prophet Muhammad. That seems to me to be a very unstable state of affairs.
Well, it's a criminal act if you do that in the eyes of most Muslims. It's very insulting. You know, there's laws in the United States and in France and other places against, for instance, anti-Semitism or denying the Holocaust, which there should be.
Well,
rightly
in
so.
The United States there aren't no such laws at all. You're free to do that?
Well, there are limits to what people can do in terms of attacking other people. The law limits what you can
do. There are no limits to speech. Speech is protected in the United States. I mean, you can insult any religion or faith, as vile as it may be, and that is protected.
Yeah, but if you incite people to violence, then the law will stop you. And in Europe, you have many countries that have made clear limits against these things, and rightly so. And therefore, yes, you can incite people to anger and violence in many cases if you insult their prophet and their religion, because the role of religion in the lives of most Muslims around the world, who live mostly in non-democratic countries, in poor countries with disparities, corruption, etc., abuse of power, the lives of most Muslims are such that religion is about the last major thing they have that gives them protection, gives them identity, gives them dignity and a sense of hope. And if you start to puncture that, you get this kind of reactions.
Rami Khoury, I'm wondering, though, if there is a selective acceptance of what freedom of expression is. In Egypt, in many of these countries, there's plenty of anti-Jewish, anti-American propaganda. Egypt broadcast a whole television series on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Iran held a conference denying the Holocaust. As vile as those may be, to most Americans, those are that's within their right to do that.
Well, this is the debate that has to happen, and there needs to be some kind of understanding, if possible, between these different cultures. It's very hard. It takes a long time to come to an understanding of what is permissible and what is not. Some of the terrible things that happen in the Arab world, or Iran, as you described, clearly shouldn't happen. They're unacceptable morally, politically, ethically, and in any way. They happen in a context of warfare, though. I think there's a difference we have to understand. So the context sometimes makes a difference. But in the final analysis, these values are universal values. People should not insult other people with a desire to incite them to violence or to degrade them in such a devastating way in the area that is so central to their identities.
Stephen Cook, is there an argument to be made that in the United States we need to take all those things into account?
Well, I think it's clear that you cannot scream fire in a crowded movie theater. The question is whether the Muslim world writ large is a crowded movie theater. I do think that speech obviously needs to be protected. And clearly this movie clip was intended to offend as many people as possible and elicit this kind of reaction from a very small minority in the Muslim world. I think that going forward, it's going to be hard for the United States and the Muslim world to square these two very different worldviews, one in which there is virtually all speech is protected except in those very specific circumstances like yelling fire in a crowded movie theater, and collective dignity. And in fact, this is what we have witnessed in the Arab world over the course of the last 18 months, people striving to achieve the national dignity and self-empowerment that these uprisings have been about. What makes this movie trailer so raw and so difficult for people to just pass off is something that Rami said just before about people's identity. It hits at the very core of their identity. And what's happening in the Arab world right now, as Egyptians, Tunisians, Libyans, and others are building new political systems and new, more just societies, they're working out a lot of these identity issues. But at its core, the vast majority of people in this part of the world regard their religion as a core identity.
Rami Khoury, Americans, as you know, you've studied here and spent a lot of time here, are impatient. And many Americans have asked, what is happening in the Muslim world? President Obama has made overtures. He spoke in Cairo. He has tried to repair the relationship. How long will this take?
Look, we can't do very much, as you said. Yeah, there's not a lot you can do right now. You're not going to shut down the internet. You're not going to restrict free speech. But one of the things you can do is address more seriously those huge issues that have been with us, some of them for 5 or 6 decades, that create these political antagonisms between the many Arabs and Asians and Muslims and the United States government. The Arab-Israeli conflict, for instance, the implementation of UN resolutions equitably across the region, the Iran nuclear issue. There's a massive sense across the Arab world that the United States is not playing fair on these issues, is tilted against the Arabs. And this is one of the reasons why you get these outbursts against the United States. So addressing those politically contentious issues more rationally and reasonably and resolving some of these conflicts would take away a lot of the anger and reduce that foundation that allows these outbursts to happen.
That's Rami Khoury with the American University of Beirut, also a senior fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center. He spoke to us from Boston. Rami, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Stephen Cook with the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke to us from Chicago. Stephen, thanks.
A great pleasure.
We just heard about big money pouring into some of the congressional races around the country, and some of that money is breathing new life into the campaign of one unlikely candidate. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, author of books such as Kosher Sex and the Kosher Jesus, and the host of a reality show that worked with struggling couples called Shalom in the Home, is running for Congress. He's hoping to unseat the Democrat, Bill Pascrell, in a New Jersey district that is overwhelmingly Democratic. Now, up until a few weeks ago, no one really took Rabbi Shmuley's campaign seriously, not even the Republican National Committee. That is, until a super PAC created to support Rabbi Shmuley received $500,000 from the billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who is also backing many other pro-Republican groups. And now, the RNC believes the ultra-Orthodox rabbi may have a shot. And when I caught up with Rabbi Shmuley this week, he admitted that after spending his life working to build bridges, it's not so easy to fight a political campaign.
It is hard, because what I'm trying to do in this campaign is translate my values into the political arena. And a lot of the things that I did on Shalom in the Home, I'm actually trying to do in politics. I'll just give you an example. The United States really needs new values. I think that the erosion of our economy has to do with the corrosion of our values. The problem with values in America is whenever you want to talk about values that really, really harm the country, like greed and entitlements and the breakdown of the family, we can't ever talk about those things because we get caught up in gay marriage, abortion, and contraception. I call it the social-sexual trifecta. These things never go away. So trying to change the conversation is what's really difficult. But I think that it's an act of cowardice to simply say, look, you're a rabbi. You're supposed to be dealing with lofty matters. Stay in the heavens and leave us politicians to control the earth. No matter how challenging it is to our ethics, our morality, we have to try to navigate these stormy political waters if we want to make things better. I care about America as much as the next guy. Am I supposed to always sit these things out?
Well, here's a question. I mean, you know, you're a guy that lots of people like, and you had this show on TLC. And I wonder, did you ever sort of hesitate when you thought about running for office? Because, you know, you basically picked a side. You are a Republican. That means that there will be people who don't like you for that. And did you ever sort of think, maybe I should just stay out of this?
No, I never really thought that if I was going to be less popular, I shouldn't do this. Even my critics will confess that I'm not someone who's pursued popularity. I've been very disliked for many of the positions that I took. Look, I published Kosher Sex in 1999 in my community. That was really frowned upon. So it was never really a consideration that I would be disliked because I would bifurcate my audience and I would suddenly be seen as a Republican. If anything, what made me hesitate was the question of whether I could achieve my goals in politics the way I've tried to do. And the jury is out on that. I know that it largely cannot be done yet. country's too partisan, it's too divided. But let me tell you some progress that I have made. I have been very critical of the Republican obsession with the social sexual issues. And amazingly, I have not been attacked by the Republican Party leadership over it. I'm very close to Eric Cantor, the majority leader, who's a dear friend. We study Torah together. He's never told me to change the message. I think I've also made some progress in just changing the language of the debate on the economy. Right now, the debate on the economy is, the Democrats say, you Republicans are cold-hearted, you want to end social programs, and you want to give tax breaks to the rich. The Republican Party's response is, you Democrats are tax and spenders, all you're going to do is create a financial meltdown by just spending every last penny we have. My language on the economy is that can't we all agree that what people most want is human dignity, and dignity comes from self-sufficiency and self-reliance. Nobody likes to be dependent on anyone else, and everyone loves to be independent. So the focus of our economy has to be to create greater financial independence at people of all strata.
It sounds like you're trying to bring some shalom in the home to Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I think for the family it's a lot easier.
How do you think your chances look? I mean, look, President Obama won 65% of the vote in your district. Bill Pascrell won the Democratic primary by something like 20% against Steve Rothman. You have an uphill battle, but now there is $500,000 in a super PAC that is supportive of you. Do you feel more confident now?
We have no clue whatsoever what the super PAC is going to do with their funding. So what I have to do is only focus on the things that I can control. We can control our own fundraising. We can control our own messaging. We're trying to do a lot in earned media, not just in purchased media. You know, for those who look at the congressional cycle every 2 years, the presidential cycle every 4 years, and you wonder, God almighty, I've heard this stuff my whole life, same issues, same debates. Where are the new ideas? I've discovered, it's only my opinion, the reason there's no new ideas in politics is that nobody has time to think. All you're ever doing is raising money. You have no time to switch on your brain and to really think through new policies, new ideas, new initiatives that will inspire the populace. So I've really tried to do things differently. I do not spend hours and hours fundraising, much to the chagrin of the professionals who surround me. But you know, I've said to them, if our ideas are good enough, we won't have to pay for media. And when you say to me, Shmuley, well, you can't win, look at the numbers. First of all, you know, guy, miracles can happen, right? And we don't think it'll just be a miracle. Bill Pascrell just announced 2 days ago 15 of the top political consultants in the country that he's hired to defeat a short, hairy rabbi with two full-time campaign staff. That's amazing.
Rabbi Shmuley Boteach is running for Congress in New Jersey's 9th Congressional District. He spoke to us from Angleton. Rabbi Shmuley, thanks so much.
God bless you. Thank you.
And a happy new year to you.
You too. Thank you very much.
Which presidential candidate would you rather have a beer with? Polls show President Obama has been winning that likability contest, and he's been raising a lot of frosty mugs on the campaign trail, hoping to press his advantage over the teetotaling Mitt Romney. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
President Obama was holding an outdoor campaign rally in Golden, Colorado this past week when the wind shifted and the signature smell of boiling wort washed over the audience, a fragrant reminder of the nearby Coors Brewery. Tap the Rockies, Coors Light. The president's been talking a lot about beer, looking to polish his regular guy credentials, but Coors is not exactly his silver bullet. And not just because Joe Coors is running for Congress as a Republican. When Mr. Obama orders a name brand beer, it's typically Bud Light. And lately, he's also been handing out samples of a specialty White House homebrew. The secret recipe was just declassified with a video on the White House website featuring chef and brewmaster Sam Cass.
That is one incredible beer, if I do say so myself. America, I wish everybody could taste this, but We don't quite brew enough.
The White House beer is flavored with honey from the First Lady's beehive, and it could become a potent weapon in Colorado, a hive of home brewing activity. Membership in the American Home Brewers Association jumped 26% last year, and Colorado has more members than any other state.
I mean, the past couple years, it's been nothing but growth.
Nick Bruning, works at the Brew Hut, a homebrew supply store just outside of Denver, where you can buy fermenting tanks, specialty yeast, and a huge variety of steeping grains.
This is Graintopia. This is like where all of our grains are. Smells good. We go through a lot of grain in this room.
With a beer-making club called Foam on the Range, a beer festival, and a wealth of brew pubs, one of which was started by the state's governor, Colorado's Front Range has been called the Napa Valley of beer. Bruning has heard that expression, but says it's a little wide of the mark.
This is more laid back. Easy going.
And maybe that's the vibe the Obama campaign is going for. After all, Thomas Jefferson made wine at Monticello, but you won't find a recipe for Pinot Noir on the White House website. Homebrewer Steve Martignac of Parker, Colorado, has been experimenting with an India Pale Ale recipe that his wife likes. He stopped by the brew hut this past week for supplies and some advice.
It's a great place to come and hang out, and there's a wealth of knowledge in here, and so it makes my brewing a lot easier.
That's just what Bruning wants to hear.
That's what I like to do. I mean, I grow satisfaction out of making sure somebody hits, like, their desired recipe or gets the flavor that they want. I mean, it's all up to them once they leave my shop, but, you know, I can help them with techniques, experiences, failures, successes that I've had.
Listening to these guys, I wonder if maybe the president's newfound suds habit is more than just a cynical political ploy. Maybe it's the ethos of home brewing that he's trying to tap into, a hobby that's do-it-yourself, but not all by yourself. The idea that we're all in this fermenting tank together. If so, when you crack open a cold one from your own beer cellar, you didn't brew that on your own. You're standing on the six-pack shoulders of all those who came before, including that giant brewery in the foothills, where the Coors family got the beer ball rolling in Colorado almost 140 years ago.
They kind of started it for everybody, you know what I mean? I bet somebody was drinking a Coors Light when they thought, hey, I can make this better.
Yes, we can. And bottle. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has become the king of the photo op. Last week, he actually strapped into a motorized hang glider and led a flock of endangered cranes on their first migration in Siberia. In the past, he's been photographed riding horseback shirtless. He's thrown opponents to the mat in judo competitions. These are all really sounds of Putin, by the way. He's even ridden around a battleship on a Harley-Davidson.
Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin!
Apparently, he's also a concert pianist, so it got us thinking, could Vladimir Putin actually be
the most interesting man in the world?
You know the ads.
Cuba imports cigars from him.
The Ernest Hemingway-esque world traveler with the impressive resume.
Mosquitoes refuse to bite him, purely out of respect.
Now, the real most interesting man in the world also promotes Dos Equis beer.
I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I prefer Dos Equis.
His name is Jonathan Goldsmith, and he's on the phone with us from his home in Vermont. And Jonathan, for some reason, I didn't imagine that the most interesting man in the world would live in Vermont.
Oh, it's absolutely paradise on earth to us.
I was wondering if, you know, when you were sort of thinking about all these things about Vladimir Putin, does it make you a little nervous? I mean, he's pretty interesting.
Well, he is pretty interesting, and he follows direction very well. I've been consulting with him for some time.
I didn't realize it. So he actually has called you up and tried to figure out how he could become more interesting.
Absolutely. And I understand that he's doing rather well. You know, I get regular reports from Sarah, who can see his house from hers.
Uh-huh.
And
I see.
Apparently he's doing very well.
He does spend a lot of time in Siberia, actually.
He does. Yeah. It's a great place to go bare-chested while hunting polar bears.
Jonathan, I want to ask you about you because you are actually, aside from all those things that you have done, you know, your shirts never wrinkle and apparently you've won the Lifetime Achievement Award twice, but you have actually, and this is true, you have rescued a stranded climber on Mount Whitney.
That is true.
You sailed the high seas with a friend named Fernando Lamas, who is actually the inspiration for your character, the most
right.
interesting man in the world.
Absolutely is, yes. He was my sailing buddy for many years. In fact, when he passed on, I scattered his ashes.
I think it's wonderful. I always felt that the stage separates a man from the boys. You see, you are on your own. There is a different story.
His voice was so distinctive and special, and I emulated him. He was the best raconteur I've ever known. It was wonderful to be around him and to listen to him, and he made everybody smile.
Jonathan, you have been an actor for pretty much your entire career. How did you land this role?
this role was, it was a day like any others. I got a call from my agent, who is now my wife, and she said, you have to do an improvisation for this commercial, and you have to end with the line, and that's how I arm wrestled Fidel Castro. Well, fine. So, and I just went into a stream of consciousness. I became outlandish, and the further out I went, the more they seemed to like it, and I was the lucky guy that got it. And this is the sound of knocking wood. There you go.
What's been your favorite moment in the Interesting Man saga?
Well, there were two interesting moments. I was sitting in a little Mexican restaurant with my wife that we liked, and a gentleman came over with his young son in tow and said, the other day I asked my son what he wanted to do when he grew up, and he said, I want to be the most interesting man in the world. He was seven. And I guess a week or so later, we were on a bus in New York City, and as an elderly gentleman with a cane was getting off, he did a double take. He saw me, and he tapped me. He knighted me on the shoulder, and he says, when I come back, sonny, I want to be you. So I guess those were two wonderful moments that I had among many.
So you get, I'm assuming you get recognized quite a bit.
I do. It's one of the reasons we moved to Vermont.
That's Jonathan Goldsmith. He's the actor who plays the most interesting man in the world for the Dos Equis ad campaign. And Jonathan Goldsmith, thank you so much, and stay thirsty, my friend.
Thank you, and you as well.
Coming up in this part of the program, how an obscure Korean hip-hop star came to dominate the U.S. pop charts. But first, a question. Why did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad cross the road? Well, Christian scholar Brian McLaren attempts to answer this question in his new book of the same name. For decades, McLaren's been a major voice in the emerging church. That's a Christian movement that essentially rejects the organized, institutionalized church in favor of a less rigid environment. His book is an attempt to imagine a conversation between the most important figures in Western theology.
If Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad were to bump into each other along the road and go have a cup of tea or whatever, I think we all know they would treat one another far different and far better than a lot of their followers would.
I want to ask about your background. You were raised in a conservative evangelical household.
Yes, that's right.
And you were taught to respect other faiths, but you were also taught to kind of maintain a distance, right, from others.
You know, in my background, you kept a distance unless you were trying to evangelize, and evangelize was defined as proselytize. So the goal was to get someone to question their faith and then switch sides. So some in my background, and I was among them, were very eager to reach out and get connected to other people, but there was always this hidden agenda of a kind of conversion.
You call this the conflicted religious identity syndrome, and this is something that you say you have struggled with since you were a teenager. How did you come to change your view?
Well, I think a lot of people feel this conflicted religious identity syndrome. There's something good and precious in their faith that they would never want to betray. But there's also something in their faith that they feel puts static into every relationship with people who aren't of their community. I certainly felt that. I felt it in my relationship with gay people. I felt it in relationship with Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist or atheist friends. And it was especially difficult for me because I was a pastor for 24 years, and the pastorate is not always the easiest place to go through a theological meltdown and rebuilding. But one of the great advantages of that is that I couldn't walk away from it. I had to stick with it. And so my story really is the story of having to rethink what it means to have a Christian identity and to be a committed Christian.
Is there a kind of a reciprocal challenge as well, though? I mean, one could argue that there are Muslims and Jews and others in this country and around the world who may also have views of Christianity that may mirror your views or the views that you believe many Christians have of other faiths.
Yes, that's such an important point to make, Guy. You know, when you write a book, sometimes you have it all figured out before you start. But for me, usually it's a discovery process. And I remember this aha moment that came to me as I was doing some research and writing. it's typical for people to say that what causes tension between religions is our differences. But I've become more and more convinced that the real issue is something we all have in common. And that is we build a strong identity among us by emphasizing hostility toward them. We love to recount the stories of how they persecuted us. We love to talk about the threat they posed to us. And in all of these ways, we build this oppositional identity. Well, I wrote the book as a Christian, primarily for Christians, but I've had a lot of my Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, atheist, and other friends read the book, and they say, oh my goodness, this fits us as well. So I think there is this fascinating mirror image, as you said, where we in some ways can see our own hostility reflected in the hostility of others.
I'm speaking with the author and theologian Brian McLaren. His new book is called Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. I want to ask about homosexuality.
Yes.
This has become a divisive issue within the evangelical church and within Christianity at large.
Yes.
You have four sons. One of them is gay. Mm. How did that change your own views on homosexuality?
Well, it was such an interesting process for me, Guy, because I had gone through my change in this view before I ever guessed that any of my kids might be gay. And it was a painful process. I was a good kid. I believed what I'd been told. And as a pastor, I started having gay people come out to me. And what became clearer and clearer to me is that their experience was not explained by the theology I inherited, and that it would be unjust to continue to uphold what I'd been taught. Maybe I could say it like this. My call to love God and love my neighbor was in conflict with what I'd been taught the Bible required me to say and do. So I went through that shift in my own thinking a couple of years after that, when I really, in some ways, come out myself as a person who no longer supported the traditional view. And one of my sons came out to me. I just remember I cried and cried because my thought is, oh no, if my son has been going through the same kind of pain so many other people did, and I didn't know it, I just couldn't live with that. And when my son and I got together and had a deep heart-to-heart talk, he told me, oh no, Dad, I wasn't worried about you guys. And so that was a great relief.
Brian, you are part of a relatively new movement in evangelical Christianity called the Emerging Church. Can you explain what that movement is about?
Yes. Well, what happened was back in the 90s, a lot of pastors like myself started realizing that young people were dropping out of the church. And this started among evangelicals because evangelicals love to count people. We keep better track of numbers than just about anybody else. And what many of us have heard from hundreds and hundreds and thousands of young Christian dropouts is that they didn't want to stay part of a community that put them in a conflictual relationship with their friends and neighbors. Ironically, their Christian call to love their neighbors as themselves was in conflict with their experience of living as a Christian and experiencing something other than love with their neighbors.
We, from time to time, have talked to other folks involved with the Emerging Church, Jay Baker and others, and we have folks on our staff who go to church on Sunday at a bar or at a coffee house. It's not a church. It's
yes.
Just a place where people meet, and there's a kind of a lay pastor, and that's the service. We hear these stories with more frequency, stories of young people who are attracted to the faith and to spirituality, but not to a building where, you know, the traditional church meets and things happen. Do you find that encouraging? Do you see that as the future of where Christianity should go?
Guys, you can imagine I get asked that question a lot, partly because I travel a lot and get to see so many of these communities. I think all of these have a bright future. Here's what I think is very different from the past. In the past, we always argued about whose form was legitimate. You know, Catholics said Protestants weren't legitimate. Protestants said Catholics weren't legitimate. Just about everybody said Pentecostals weren't legitimate for a long time. But I think we might be entering into an era where we stop arguing with each other about legitimacy. I think this could be a very exciting new era if we look around and say, thank God for the diversity. This diversification doesn't have to mean division.
That's writer and theologian Brian McLaren. His new book is called Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. Brian McLaren, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And it's time now for music. Open Gangnam Style. And the music video for this Korean pop song Gangnam Style has rocketed one musician to international stardom. It's the work of rapper Jae Song Park. He goes by the name Psy, and for 12 years he's had a pretty successful career in South Korea. But now, thanks to the video for Gangnam Style, Psy is on top of the world. The video has also launched a dance craze in which Psy gallops like a horseback rider and swings a lasso. It's the most viewed Korean pop music video ever on YouTube, 170 million views. He's done The Ellen Show, The Today Show, the MTV Music Awards, and he's now just signed a deal with Justin Bieber's manager. In fact, just today, the song Gangnam Style reached number one on the U.S. iTunes chart. And remember, this is a song in Korean. And now the phenomenon otherwise known as Psy joins me from New York. Psy, welcome to the program.
What's up?
First of all, congratulations on your success.
Thank you so much.
170 million views on YouTube. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I'm still surprising every day.
You didn't imagine it would happen?
Never. I just made my album, I did my best, and I uploaded the video just at YouTube. That was all. And within 60 days, I'm here and make an interview with you.
I mean, I'm here talking to you, so I gotta tell you, I've seen your video maybe 20 times, maybe 30 times.
Ah,
it
come
is
on.
Addictive.
Make it more, please.
All right,
from now
on. I'm gonna boost up the YouTube views. All right, first of all, tell us, what is Gangnam Style?
Gangnam Style, let me describe it. Gangnam's like a territory in Seoul, Korea. I describe it as a noble at the daytime and going crazy at the nighttime. I compare ladies to the territory, so noble at the daytime, going crazy at the nighttime. The lyric says, I am the right guy for the lady who's like that.
I watched you appear, you appeared on the Ellen DeGeneres Show with Britney Spears.
Yeah.
And you taught her the dance.
Yes.
I'm doing it right now. I'm lassoing that, doing that lasso part. What is the story behind that kid who dances with you in the video wearing the sleeveless T-shirt?
Oh, yeah,
In the park in Seoul. What's the story behind that?
You know, you have the program called America's Got Talent, right?
Yeah.
In Korea, we have Korea's Got Talent, and the boy came out from Korea's Got Talent. You know, he's 5 years old, but you know what? He started to do all the Michael Jackson moves when he was three. So I'm going to bring the kids sometime next visit.
Oh, that's going to be huge. He's got to bring him on stage with you. You actually studied at the Berklee College of Music. Is that right?
Yes, I was.
What did you study there?
Well, my major was music business, but honestly, class was too early for me.
So you actually never showed up for class?
Not at all. And I was young at that time, so the young thought was it's all about creation and I cannot learn any creation from others. That was my thought at that time, so I didn't go there.
How do you speak English so well?
Well, I didn't attend the school, but I was there still, so
yeah.
I gotta speak some English in the market or gas station. And, you know, it's only four-year-old English, so I have a lot of interviews, and you're asking some things, and I got to answer quickly. So I got to translate all my answers in my brain. So right now, I'm really tired because I woke up so early because of the Today Show. But, you know, after all this, I'm not going to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
I'm going to go get some drink, and which is soju bomb.
Oh, you can get a soju bomb?
All right. Yeah.
You are actually quite possibly the biggest export from Korea to the U.S. since the Hyundai.
Thank you. Thank you for the mention.
Do you think that K-pop is now, like, has found its moment in America, that Americans might hear a lot more of it?
Yeah, so as you see, like, I cannot say Korean's best, but I can say Korean has a lot of potentials. They are so dynamic. So if I can do something little to make some chances to other Koreans, then I will please to do that.
Oppan Gangnam Style.
Now you have just been signed by
Scooter Braun.
By Scooter Braun, Justin Bieber's manager. He says he's going to make you an even bigger star in the U.S. What are you guys planning to do?
Well, actually, like a week ago, we were saying like, hey, I'm going to promote myself because, you know, music videos much more popular than I am. So I don't like the situation. But in a week, especially after Ellen's show and today's show, when I'm walking down the street, like some of them recognize me finally today. So me and Scooter thinking like, should we prepare for the next single or something? So we are beginning to make that kind of conversation about my next step.
Have you managed to meet Justin Bieber yet?
I think it's going to be sometime early next week.
Oh, really?
We just made a phone call today.
Wow. Are you going to record with Justin Bieber, by the way?
Well, if song fits to us and if it is suitable for both of us, then why not?
You going to take him to Gangnam and live the high life?
We just promised that we're going to drink all night long.
All right. Okay. You heard it here first. Are you going to, by the way, are you planning to record any music in English?
Oh, yeah. That's one of my next steps. But I got to think about it because I can speak English, but still, if I have a chance, I want my music lyric to be Korean because Gangnam Style's working right now, right?
Yeah.
The world's most famous and popular language is music. So if we have some sort of like solution with this kind of dance moves and this kind of music video so that I can use Korean if possible, then it's really huge history for my country. So I'm thinking about that too.
That's Jae-sung Park. He's better known as Psy. The music video for his song Gangnam Style is the most viewed K-pop video in YouTube history. 170 million views. It's rocketing up the Billboard charts as well. Psy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Oppan Gangnam Style.
Just as the punk scene started to turn a corner in the late 1970s, a young and exciting British musician was starting to get noticed for a sound that would soon be called New Wave, and his name was Joe Jackson. Pretty soon now, you know I'm gonna make a comeback. Joe Jackson seemed the perfect bridge from punk to New Wave. He was angry, but also musically talented. He wore sharp suits, but his words were often biting, even political. And just as suddenly, Joe Jackson changed course. His big piano-heavy songs became huge hits in the 1980s, and then he changed again. Over and over throughout his career, Joe Jackson has taken on any musical challenge, from symphonies to swing. And now he's paying tribute to a fellow musical pioneer, Duke Ellington. But when the weekend's over and Monday rolls around, I end up like I start out just This is from Joe Jackson's latest album, The Duke, and as you can tell, it's not meant as a faithful note-for-note recreation of Duke Ellington. As a matter of fact, in honoring the music of one of the greatest big band composers of all time, Joe Jackson decided to all but abandon horns.
That was the first real decision I made when I started to think that this could be an album. I think sometimes you have to give yourselves rules or limitations. Because I think that you're trying to create an identity for the project. And sometimes you have to do that by what you don't do as much as what you do. And I just thought right away, well, as soon as I start using clarinets and saxophones and trumpets and trombones, it's going to start sounding like Ellington, but not as good.
Wanted to avoid imitating him or competing with the master.
Yeah. And so, all the many other people who've done their versions of Ellington. To me, they never seem to go far enough away from what Ellington did.
You have made a pretty big and bold choice for your duet partner on the song. I don't mean a thing if it's anything that swing. It is Iggy Pop.
What good is melody? What good is music if it ain't possessing something sweet? It ain't the melody, it ain't the music, it's something else that makes the tune complete.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago that he was rolling around on stage in broken glass and peanut butter.
Yeah.
Now he's swinging to Duke Ellington. How did that collaboration come about?
Well, I met him a couple of times, and I think he's a pretty cool guy, and he likes to do different things. I think he found it challenging at first. What was it he said? This ain't for sissies, I think was his comment. But I think it turned out really well.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
You've made another interesting choice on this record. The song Caravan features an Iranian singer who's translated the lyrics into Farsi.
Yeah.
And there's another song, Perdido. It's now in Portuguese.
That's right.
Why?
The one thing that I've always had a problem with Ellington is a lot of the lyrics are just awful. I mean, because I think that he didn't care much about lyrics, and most of his songs were written as instrumental pieces, and then someone put lyrics to them afterwards. And I'm sometimes inclined to believe it was the guy who just, you know, delivered the pizza or something that added the lyrics. You know, anyone here can write lyrics? Okay, now you're a lyricist. And those two songs, they were both songs that I really wanted to do, especially Caravan, which has this really interesting, strange, exotic melody. But when you actually sing it, the words are so cheesy that it spoils it for me. And I had this idea that, well, maybe it would be cool to have a couple of these songs sung in a different language. I mean, at least it would give a different slant to it. I can't vouch for how good her translation is. I mean, I don't speak Farsi, but...
you just got to trust her.
Yeah, I trust her. And, I mean, to me, it restores an exotic sort of element to the song.
I'm speaking with Joe Jackson. His latest record is called The Duke, and it features music either written by or associated with Duke Ellington. People who are fans of yours and people who know your story know that you are very, very gifted as a kid, and your gift was recognized. Your parents and others knew that, and you got this grant by the council to go and study.
Yeah, yeah.
How much do you think the trajectory of your career has to do with the fact that you were trained, that you were professionally trained? I mean, a lot of musicians today don't go to the Royal Academy or to the Berklee College of Music here in the U.S. They sort of have a band, and they get popular, and that's it, and they go make music.
That's true. I mean, when the punk scene happened in London in the late 70s, I was way overqualified already to be part of it. It never occurred to me that I was going to be too good a musician. You know, I wanted to be as good as I could be. I was going to see bands who barely knew how to tune their instruments, let alone play them. And I thought it was great fun.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've never been a snob about any kind of music. I just thought it was exciting and it was fun, and it was what it was. But at the same time, I think in pop and rock music, there's always been a lot of inverted snobbery in a way. You know, like if you are a real musician, it's somehow sort of suspect. You know, it's much cooler to be someone who can just play three chords and look good.
Did you feel that? Were you ever on the receiving end of that snobbery?
Yeah, I felt it from time to time. I mean, I think it is definitely something that exists. I think it's a myth that snobbery is something that exists in the refined worlds of classical music, for instance. I think some of the least snobbish and coolest musicians I've ever worked with have been the classical guys. Because, you know, they just care about the music, really.
When you perform live, what do you make of the people who come see you? Is it kind of a mixture of, you know, fans of this kind of music and also the fans who want to hear Stepping Out? Is she really going out with him?
People always want to hear familiar songs, and I understand that. And, you know, we generally play them because I enjoy it too. So there's no problem really there. But as far as who the audience is for this tour, as far as I can tell, it's a pretty diverse bunch, and that's all right with me. I'm just happy every time one person buys a ticket to the show. I mean, every time one person buys a record, I'm happy. I mean, I think you can't have any expectations at all. think that's a big mistake.
I mean, if you read between the lines, it sounds like you're saying you feel fortunate that you've been able to make a living in this profession.
Yes. I knew I was going to be a musician by the time I was 14 or 15 years old, and I was equally convinced that I was going to be looking at a life of poverty and obscurity, but hopefully having fun and doing what I loved. So the fact that I've done quite well and, you know, I'm still doing this, to me, that's a great success.
That's Joe Jackson. His latest record is a tribute to the music of Duke Ellington. It's called The Duke. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Joe Jackson, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the new record.
Thanks a lot.
For the week ending September 16th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Kenya Young. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Phil Harrell, Lily Percy, Brenda Salinas, Becky Sullivan, and Amy Held. Our interns are Barbara Sprunt and Acacia Squires. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in. I never saw rainbows in my wine, but now that your lips are burning mine, I'm beginning to see the light. I'm beginning to